Kenya's Women Safari Guides, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Marco Werman's on assignment in Kenya. Leading a safari there is usually considered a man's job, until Sophie Sedera pulls up in her Jeep.
One of the guests came and said, "Oh my God, are you driving? You're so tiny. We barely see you on the steering." And I was like, I wasn't happy about it.
Her story and more from Kenya coming up. Plus, it started when he picked up a scrap of paper from the barracks floor.
Mary Alice Hoffman, 911 Cherry Street, Dallas, Oregon.
He wrote her a letter, and she answered.
I think in letters, your heart comes out about who you really are and what you believe in and what your values are.
A love story 53 years in the making, ahead on The World. Marco Werman's on assignment in Kenya. And to wrap up the week, he's got stories about Kenyan women who are owning it in comedy and music and as wildlife guides. That's all coming up. But first, we begin with the fight against ISIS. That was definitely on President Obama's mind today at his annual year-end news conference.
We're going to defeat ISIS. And we're going to do so by systematically squeezing them, cutting off their supply lines, cutting off their financing, taking out their leadership, taking out their forces, taking out their infrastructure.
But in Iraq this week, it was ISIS fighters who went on the offensive. They launched an attack against Kurdish forces in northern Iraq. My BBC colleague Murad Shashani is monitoring the fighting from London. He says the extremists have been using a new strategy lately.
They are resorting to sort of that hit and run. And it seems last week they have concentrated and increased the attacks on the certain areas in order to find themselves spaces where they can run from the airstrikes.
About 180 ISIS fighters were killed in strikes that continued until Thursday morning. Sort of who won this battle? I know the Kurds put up a good fight.
The problem, we can't tell that. These statistics ongoing, we don't know for certain because we don't have independent sources from inside to tell us who's been killed on the ground and stuff. If you remember, after the American invasion in Iraq, we've been hearing many times that Al-Qaeda leaders have been killed, and suddenly we discover they were sometimes normal people or they are not high-ranked in Al-Qaeda. So it's very hard to determine that.
But isn't it important that the Kurds kind of held them off?
It's very important. Kurds are playing major role in pushing back IS in their areas. But IS also playing the same game where they don't want an open battle with the Kurds because they will be exhausted. So that's why they are resorting to hit and run in that area to keep them busy and to find themselves as spaces where they can run away from the airstrikes.
One thing I've got to ask is we hear a lot in this country from President Obama and others about all these attacks, increased level of attacks against ISIS. He's mostly talking about Syria, but I'm assuming some of those air attacks are going on in Iraq. Are they having any impact in these areas of northern Iraq that we're talking about?
It's true that the airstrikes in Syria are more powerful, if you'd like, than what's happening in Iraq. The problem is in Syria, there are when the civilians have been hit in any attack, that increases the anger. More people become more supportive to IS.
How is public support for ISIS on the ground?
It's very important to understand one of the major issues that IS rely on in gaining support is the division based on sectarian affiliation. There's a sectarian division in the region, and they play on that. Let's say in Iraq case that the Shia dominated government is attacking you because you are Sunni, so they are attracting those youngsters who've lost the hope. They can't see sort of a discrimination against them on a daily basis. There's no hope for future. So IS, in a way or another, are representing a sort of an alternative solution for those youngsters. So it's true that they have brutal measures. They have very bad ruling day-to-day ways, treat other religious minorities very badly. However, there are sort of grievances on the ground which exploit it to recruit more youngsters.
Do they offer anything practically that helps Iraqis or Syrians on the ground?
Many people I spoke to them, they said at least protection, and they feel themselves they are belonging to sort of identity for a bigger idea. At least they feeling themselves they are controlling their own areas, actually, because of the protection of IS.
My BBC colleague, Murad Shishani. He's been covering events in Iraq for many years. Thanks so much, Murad.
Thank you.
The U.S. military presence in Iraq and Afghanistan is much smaller now than it used to be, but some American troops are still there, and especially in Afghanistan, lots of U.S. taxpayer dollars are still being spent. The reporters at ProPublica have been looking into where that money has gone over the years. In fact, they've collated some remarkable statistics and stories about how taxpayer dollars have been wasted in Afghanistan in the last few years. The data is drawn from the findings of the U.S. government's own Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. Megan McCluskey wrote the piece for ProPublica. Megan, give us your favorite examples of waste.
Oh, there are so many. I think the best example are the planes we bought for $486 million that never really made it off the ground. And we, in fact, ended up junking them for scrap metal for the grand sum of $32,000, which comes out to 6 cents on the pound.
I was curious about the $3 million spent on patrol boats that were never used.
Oh, yes. Those boats that the military bought but could not say why they bought them or what they were going to do with them. And then the boats never made it out of a naval storage facility in Virginia.
There are some interesting categories here. You have a column for outright waste and another for on the brink. What's the difference? And give us an example.
Oh, sure. So outright waste are items like the planes that couldn't fly, things that there's no way they could be used now. So, for example, we built several military headquarters that were intended for when U.S. troops were across the country. And now those troops have gone home and nobody ever used those headquarters. So that's completely wasted. A lot of times they're built with complex systems or with American power outage. And so the Afghans couldn't use them even if they wanted to, and they don't. And then there is on the brink, which is more like things that are at risk that are not waste today, but could very easily be waste tomorrow. For example, in both Helmand and Kandahar provinces, the military bought power equipment that is just way beyond the capabilities of the Afghans to use. And so about $20 million worth of it has just been sitting in storage. So right now, technically not waste because somebody could eventually do something with it, but it's very highly unlikely that they will.
How much money are we talking about altogether in terms of spending that was just a waste?
About $17 billion.
That's billion with a B.
Billion with a B.
And that's since 2009.
Yes.
So there's kind of practical considerations about overly ambitious projects that don't make sense given a war going on or given a lack of infrastructure to begin with. But then there seems to be a sense of no accountability. That was one of the things that struck me in reading the report.
Absolutely. Yeah, there are folks who have been in charge of oversight of projects that have been complete failures and nothing ever happens to them. There's no responsibility that's taken. Most of the agencies shrug their shoulders in some ways and saying that, hey, doing this in a war zone is hard and it's just a challenge. And so people are not held accountable for failings. Like there was a justice center that was supposed to be built north of Kabul, supposed to be a prominent place for Afghan national security trials. And it's nothing but rebar because no one actually built it. And nobody who was in charge of that project was held accountable for that failing.
You called the Pentagon for your story. How did they respond?
Well, they completely disagreed that $17 billion was questionable spending. They have also disagreed with SIGAR quite a bit over the years of their assessments.
And SIGAR is the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction.
Yes. They in particular have disagreed with the Special Inspector General in terms of their assessments of the security forces. They have highlighted the Special Mission Wing, which is supposed to be counterterrorism and counter-narcotics, as particularly troublesome, saying there's not enough personnel, not enough pilots, they're not trained, they can't do maintenance. And the Pentagon very vehemently says, no, they're active, they're working, and it's just going to take some time.
Megan McCluskey of ProPublica, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You can read the ProPublica report at PRI.org. How to prevent waste is also on the minds of some students in Paris. Their city just hosted the climate talks that ended on an optimistic note with the adoption of a new global agreement. Then all the delegates went home. But these students are using the summit as inspiration for their own efforts, and they're starting in their school cafeteria. Here's Adeline Sear from Paris.
It's lunchtime at this large public school in Paris. The Honoré de Balzac School in the 17th arrondissement has 2,000 middle and high school students. So lunch is fast, busy, and messy. It's even messier today since there's a food waste experiment going on. Students in hairnets and protective clothing are sorting and weighing leftovers from the lunch trays. Bread, meat, rice and vegetables, and packaging all go in separate bags. It's part of a project the school came up with to coincide with the Paris Climate Conference. You're not eating this apple? Says a student sorting waste to a schoolmate. You'll never grow up. In one corner of the cafeteria, a pile of leftover yogurt containers is growing. According to strict food regulations here, they have to be thrown out, even if they're still unopened. Environmental science teacher Jean-Baptiste Lambert says this experiment today is a fact-finding phase. They want to determine what can be recycled, whether portions should be reduced, and what can be composted. Compost will be key here, he says. Because the climate conference was taking place in their city, Lambert wanted to get his students' hands dirty, literally. So they came up with the idea of composting with earthworms. But the worms only eat a vegetarian diet, so Lambert says it'll take a while to sort out the food waste for them. In this high school, Shaden Al-Yahya Morla and Noor Fiqueh were expected to be student stars of the Paris Climate Conference. The 12th graders won a student environmental journalism competition.
We wanted to show people how dead leaves can create biogas.
Shaden says they determined biogas from decomposing leaves from the schoolyard could be used to heat the school's pool. For their prize, she and Noor were invited to spend a day at the conference. But in France's state of emergency, that just didn't happen.
We were really excited to go, but then with the attacks, it wasn't possible anymore. So we were a bit sad, but it's not to go there that it's important. We just wanted to show our ideas to other schools.
Shaden says she was pleased with the final agreement's global warming target of 1.5 degrees, but her friend Noor feels differently.
Je veux pas dire que j'étais pas contente, etc. Mais c'est pas que j'y crois pas vraiment. Mais pour moi, il y a déjà une grande partie. Enfin, pour moi, c'est un peu trop tard.
It's not that I wasn't happy about the agreement, she says. It's not that I don't believe in it, but for me, this is happening way too late. Noor says she doesn't trust the French government to enforce the agreement. In the afternoon, the results of the day's cafeteria experiment come in. 110 pounds of compostable waste, enough to make the worms happy. But there was also 300 pounds of non-compostable waste, plus 53 unopened containers of yogurt. It all went in the trash. But as one teacher put it, the climate conference has made them think about connections to their everyday activities in school, from recycling paper to food waste, and what they can do here to make a difference. For the world, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
Driving a safari vehicle in Kenya is not just a man's job. Meet one of the women who do it too, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We've been checking in every day this week with Marco Werman, who's in Kenya. He's there with our team looking across women's lives, specifically at women in business, hashtag owning it. They've introduced us to Kenyan women who are doing all sorts of things, farming, yoga, even running a savings club to stand up to poverty and try to change their world. Now, when many of us think Kenya, we think wildlife, lions, elephants, giraffes, zebras. And yes, women are working with wildlife, too. And Marco, I hear you've got a story of one of just a handful of women guides in Kenya. And this woman works in the country's great national reserve park known as the Masai Mara.
Yeah, true enough, Carol. I come to you today from the urban wildlife of Nairobi. That was a baby elephant named Boromoko leaving its grazing area, returning to its cage. I'm at the David Sheldrick Elephant and Rhino Orphanage. It's just outside the capital. Here they're saving baby elephants, rhinos, giraffes, who've actually been orphaned when their parents have been killed by poachers. They're saving them one animal at a time, and many of the orphans are from the Masai Mara, just a way to kind of set the mood for the real game drive we're about to take in the Masai Mara. Our Across Women's Lives video journalist, Anne Bailey, is reporting this one. And Anne, you've been chasing the story about Sophie Sedera for a while, one of a handful of women game drivers in Kenya, in all of Kenya. You finally got to meet her last week. She works on the extraordinary plains of the Maasai Mara. And just set the scene for us. Describe this universe she lives in.
It's really pretty incomprehensible, Marco. When you first arrive and you look out on these plains, you see all these little dots that are basically desert date trees. And Mara actually in Maasai means spotted, and that's where this name Mara came from, the spotted plain.
And some of those spots are trees, and some of those spots are animals. So tell us what you saw.
Yeah, so I went out with Sophie, and she picked us up early in the morning. We did an early morning game drive. And when the drive started, we all said kind of what animal we wanted to see. You know, I wanted to see an elephant or a lion. Isis, who was another member of our team, wanted to see a cheetah, which was a little bit rare. But we ended up seeing all those things.
Tell me about the moment with the cheetah.
Yeah, it was kind of up on a little hill, hanging out and casing the area, looking for its next meal.
So, Sophie, we just saw this cheetah walking, and it's now kind of up on this mount. How common is that to see a cheetah?
They're looking for food. You'll see them sitting on top of termite mounds. Or cheetahs are very scared of getting injured. Might be looking for the place just to make sure that it's safe before it moves on.
Is a cheetah like this just traveling on its own? Are there other cheetahs we're just not seeing right now?
Cheetahs are solitary. You'll see them by themselves. Not unless you see a coalition of two or three brothers together. Or a mother with the cubs.
Right after that, we actually saw this cheetah take down an impala. And the way that it's stalking these impala was just incredible. And from a distance, we were able to see it kind of hunker down, and then it just went for it, and it got one.
Now, people can see this later at PRI.org in the video, but at one point, you encounter some elephants, and they're not going to let you pass by them. Tell me about that.
We were driving down the road. Sophie pointed out that there were some elephants far up, so we just kind of parked and waited to see what they would do. And they all kind of slowly converged onto the main road that we were on and that the other safari vehicles were on.
Yeah, they have the right of way. We have to respect them and give them the way.
So how do we know that they're not angry with us right now?
Actually, you can tell when they get angry. You'll see them like shaking their heads or flapping their ears rapidly. Then you can tell they're not happy, and then you'll just move back and give them way.
And so right now the front one there, is she not happy with her ears are kind of flapping a little bit? So at the time when the elephants were coming, Sophie was very, very calm. But later that night, I sat down with her, and she did say that encounter was a little bit too close for her and that we really needed to not have been quite that close in.
All right, let's hear some more of that conversation. And you asked her how she got into game driving and what her family thought about it when she was a kid.
I must say that my mother has worked very hard for me to, like, start schooling because she educated me, like, from zero to where I am at the moment. But after high school, I just wanted to go and study more about wildlife. And then my mother was like, no, when you study wildlife, what do you like to be? I like to be a guide. And then she's like, no, that's a man's thing. Do you think you can do it? And then I was like, yes, I think I can do it, because if they are doing it, I will also do it. At the moment, I must say that she's the happiest mom.
Has she been on a safari with you?
My younger brother and sister, they have been on safari, but my mother not yet. One day.
So you went to guiding school for about a year.
Yeah.
And how many women were in guiding school with you compared to the number of men?
The whole class, we were 23 students in that class, and 7 of them were ladies. And I know we are only 3 of us. And then the rest, it's kind of they've given up due to discouragement from people, or some of them get married and then their husband kind of discourage them. That's a man's thing. Why don't you do something better? And I know of most of them that they're doing teaching.
So we took another safari this afternoon with another female safari guide, Charity, at a different camp. And one of the things that really struck me was that both of you know every other female guide in the Maasai Mara area. And one of the cool things that you said was that both of you at some point have had kind of a negative experience with either a client who didn't want to go out with you because you were a woman, or, you know, fellow guides even who were kind of not super supportive of you.
One of the guests from a different vehicle
came and said, oh my God, are you driving? You're so tiny. We barely see you on the steering. And I was like, I wasn't happy about it because she was saying that to me in front of my guests. But at least my guests were just really happy about it. And then they were like, she's very smart.
I have to say, between you and Charity, I felt incredibly calm out on these safaris today. And you both were just so knowledgeable about what was going on. You had said that you also work a little bit with girls, trying to get younger girls to be interested in science or to possibly think about becoming a guide.
Mm-hmm. Here in the Maasai community, many girls, they get married off at a very early age. Some of them can just finish unit 8, that's in primary level, and then they kind of, I'm done. And then they go off and get married. But I always go and try and encourage them. That's not enough for them. They have to study more, maybe study sciences. But most of them, when they see you like driving guest, when you ask them, what do you like to be in future? They say, I'd love to be a tour guide like you. Even if you get married by whoever who will be working, it's also good for you to have something or to have a job of your own.
Sophie, thank you so much. It was really incredible meeting you.
You're most welcome next time.
That was a wonderful interview, and I am so envious of your experience. But, you know, just driving out to Masai Mara, I got to see zebras and warthogs and elephants and giraffes. I even caught a glance of a lion's mane from the distance. So, listeners, you got to experience Sophie's world and the wildlife in the Mara at PRI.org. Gorgeous pictures. Check it out. What a place. What a simply incredible part of the planet. So lucky to have even tasted that. And remember, you can see what was going on there at PRI.org in a fabulous video that Anne produced. And thank you so much for telling us about Sophie Sidera.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman in Nairobi, Kenya. Sophie Sidera, she definitely owns it. We're going to be back later in the program with more Owning It, a woman who's making it in comedy, and a musical surprise from a local singer who's given a Swahili treatment to a great song that's sitting at number one on the U.S. charts for the 7th week in a row. You'll definitely want to stick around for that. You're listening to The World.
I'm Carol Hills. Kansini Anne is a popular comedy star in Kenya, and her routine usually ends with women winning out against their men.
I always win all arguments, as a matter of fact. But I don't know how else to put, I'm a woman. I mean, if I'm not on my side, I don't know which other side I'm supposed to be on.
East Africa's queen of comedy. Her story, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Marco Werman is in Kenya, and he'll be joining us from there one more time later in the show. But first, friends in the U.S. have both been rethinking their security in recent weeks in the wake of the Paris and San Bernardino attacks. But concerns about terrorism are also spurring action in other countries. Germany, for instance, just announced a new counterterrorism police unit. Some still worry, though, that German police forces aren't prepared enough. The World's Matthew Bell has more from Berlin.
The Charlie Hebdo killings early this year sparked a big public discussion in Germany. What emerged from the debate is the fact that German police forces might find themselves heavily outgunned if something like the Paris attack happened in Berlin. To talk about this, I visited a private shooting club in a little village outside the capital where off-duty police officers go for some recreational target practice. A veteran Berlin officer who doesn't want to give his name tells me he loves his M16. He jokingly refers to it as his American girlfriend.
It's not too heavy from the weight here. It is very fast, and it hits very exactly. It's good. I like it.
But this is not a police weapon. When he's on duty, he's armed with a 9mm handgun and one ammunition clip, nothing else. The M16 is this officer's personal property. He only wishes that Berlin cops had guns like this.
Why do you think the police need this kind of serious assault weapon?
For a long distance. Not only for a short distance like a handgun, it's for a long distance.
If you go against guys with Kalashnikovs,
that's the problem. Kein Gleichgewicht, also nichts gegenzusetzen.
Switching to German, he says, it's not a fair fight. Germany does have one unit of police special forces, like a SWAT team. They have fully automatic weapons, body armor, the whole deal. They're based in Bonn, the old West German capital. That's one reason for this new counterterrorism unit. It's being deployed in several cities, and the officers are armed and equipped to respond to terrorist attacks. But when it comes to the cops on the streets of German cities, it's a very different story. Steve Feldman is a spokesman with the Berlin Police Union.
Das Problem ist, die Streifenpolizisten, also police officers in America, sind ja die ersten am Ort.
The problem is that our local police don't have the weapons or the body armor to handle anything like what happened in Paris. If something like this does happen here, our police officers are going to end up being cannon fodder.
Feldman says the Berlin police have requested better body armor and been refused. He agrees that they need more firepower, including machine guns. But even if they get those guns today, he says, his officers are not trained to use them. And Feldman adds, there's another problem.
Die Wahrheit ist, dass wir viele Polizisten in Berlin haben in der von der Hauptstadtpolizei.
The truth is that many Berlin police officers have not fired a single shot over the last 1 to 3 years. That's because we don't have enough shooting ranges. So what they did was try to do some training with laser tags. We can't sugarcoat things here. This is an extremely dangerous situation.
Feldman says the creation of the new counterterrorism force is good news, but it's only one step in the right direction. To be sure, this is all pretty scary stuff to be talking about. For decades, Europeans had the luxury of not having to worry about the kind of mass casualty shootings that happen regularly in the U.S. For one thing, Germany doesn't have much of a gun culture. But Feldman and others say the German public and German politicians might need to start thinking more seriously about new kinds of threats and how best to prepare for them. For The World, Matthew Bell, Berlin.
Right now, a certain movie is making all the headlines. Lightsabers, anyone? Star Wars is just the kind of Hollywood blockbuster that ends up dubbed into dozens of languages and dominates movie screens everywhere. But American film studios are going global in a different way, too. They're making movies specifically for foreign markets in their local languages. These studios go to, say, Brazil and work with local producers, actors, and directors. I called up Courtney Brannon Donahue to find out more. She teaches cinema studies at Oakland University.
So what's so unique about this is that these are partnerships with local production companies and distributors. And so they're not doing it on their own. They're working with Brazilian screenwriters or Brazilian production companies to make films in Portuguese for the Brazilian market. And so the idea is that they're not expected to travel. They're expected to be particularly for that market.
How successful have American studios been in doing these local films?
Well, they've had problems and they've had some successes. It's depending on the studio. But there have been a number of hits. And so on the best case scenario, they've had local blockbusters. And so these are not like $250 million budget Spider-Man, Star Wars blockbusters, but these are films that are commercial. They're genre films with local stars that have broken box office records in Argentina or Germany. And actually last year, Universal released a film in Spain that was the second top grossing film of all time.
And what was that?
Ocho Apellidos Vascos. So it was a comedy. It was a Spanish comedy that was a huge phenomenon. And that's the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is an example when Disney tried to localize High School Musical and the Chinese version was a complete disaster.
Do the local production houses, say in Brazil or Russia or China or France, do they get annoyed that, oh gosh, here's the U.S. again? First it was exporting its big blockbusters and now it's actually, you know, horning in on our market and making homegrown movies right there.
Yeah, talking to some producers, some independent producers in the some of these markets, they're frustrated because they're using tax incentives, they're using subsidies, and these films are meeting quotas to where it is a Spanish film, it is a Brazilian film, even though there's a Hollywood studio involved. On the flip side, you have a number of these big powerhouse local producers that see this as mutually beneficial. They see these relationships as local creators working with these Hollywood distribution companies and getting their films released farther and having more success.
You know, Hollywood's always been criticized as not being diverse enough. Do you think producing movies in other countries could potentially change that in the long run?
There are a lot of debates going on right now domestically about the lack of representation in front of and behind the camera of marginalized groups. And I think that they're slowly realizing that they can't make the same kind of American point of view, large stories anymore, and they're not going to appeal to audiences outside the U.S., that they're not telling the stories that are familiar and specific to these audiences.
Yeah, because I guess I wonder if American studios start working with local actors, producers, and directors in other countries, do they ever end up, you know, having them come to the U.S. to work directly with studios or vice versa?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's part of it as well. And so you talk to some of the international executives at the studios in L.A., and they see it as a way to find talent, whether it's screenwriters, directors, actors in other markets, and work with them. And so that you see that on occasion. So, for example, Jose Padilla, who is a Brazilian director who ended up directing the reboot of RoboCop and most recently Narcos on Netflix. And so you have a filmmaker that becomes commercially successful in Brazil and makes that jump.
Courtney Brannon Donahue is a cinema studies professor at Oakland University. Thanks, Courtney.
Thanks, Carol. It's my pleasure.
Our next story is about love and war and a mysterious piece of paper. Mary and Royce Thorpe of Dallas, Oregon, met by chance 53 years ago. It started with that scrap of paper I mentioned. Royce picked it up off the floor inside a U.S. Navy barracks in California. This was just before he was deployed to Vietnam. From there, I'll let Mary and Royce tell the story themselves in their own words.
That particular day, it was my turn to be the person in the barracks when the inspection team came around. And just before they showed up, I was doing a walk around, and I saw a piece of paper on the floor. I can't throw it in a trash can because the trash cans have to be spit polished clean. I can't put it in my pocket because they're going to inspect me too. So I put the piece of paper in my wallet. Forgot about it. Finally get my orders. I was assigned to the USS Currituck. So they flew me to Tokyo. We were actually headed for Vietnam. We got to Hong Kong. That was one of our main stops. And it was my night to stand duty on the bridge. Well, if it was during the day, you would have seen fishing boats and like that out doing their thing. But middle of the night, nothing's going on. So I thought, okay, I'll clean up my wallet. Clean out paper. Oh, here's that piece of paper. And opened it up and said, oh, Mary Alice Hoffman, 911 Cherry Street, Dallas, Oregon.
I was a senior at Dallas High School. It was in January. And I get a letter from a sailor that I didn't know. I called my mother and I said, Mom, get this letter from some guy I don't know, and he's in the Navy. She says, oh, write to him. He's probably lonely. You'll never meet him. So I wrote back a letter of introduction. And the first thing I told him was I was a Christian because I thought, you know, if he doesn't like that, I won't hear back, and that's fine.
Every port we'd stop in, they'd have a mailbag waiting for us. So there's a letter there. I think she told me she had two brothers, that she likes to sing. She was in the high school choir and things like that.
I had no idea how old he was, nor did I know what he looked like. When I sent him my picture, and then he didn't send a picture back, I'm thinking, oh, he's probably 40 years old and bald. Finally, he did send a picture and told me his age. And the picture, I'm thinking, wow, very handsome. But I always would spray the letters with perfume.
I wasn't nervous about it. I once wrote a letter to President Eisenhower. I'd never met him before either. It was just something different to do. You could think about something other than the next chore you had to do. And at that point in my life, I was kind of footloose and fancy free. I didn't have any real ties. I thought, okay, I'm going to figure out how to go see her.
I think in letters, your heart comes out about who you really are and what you believe in and what your values are. That's what I got from him.
We get back to the States. I had 3 weeks leave. And I'm going to hitchhike back to Michigan, but I'm going to take the long route. I'm going to hitchhike up to Oregon, stop to see this young lady, and then hitchhiking to Michigan. Had my duffel bag, stuck my thumb out, and headed north. There was this one black couple picked me up and hauled me for ways. And then there's this other guy who's getting really tired. He says, "You drive?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "I need to get some sleep. You want to drive for a couple hours for me?" "Sure." Guy dropped me off at the bus station in Salem. And I had her phone number. And so I called, and she wasn't home yet. She was at an operetta practice.
So my neighbor was dropping me off, and his mom came out on the front porch, and she said, "Oh, the other neighbor went to pick up that sailor in Salem at the bus depot." I just jumped out of the car and ran in the house to go freshen up.
She came in, and I stood up and greeted her, you know, and we shook hands, and then we just actually ended up spending the next 2.5 weeks touring Oregon. I never did make it back to Michigan.
He would walk down Main Street, and Dallas is just a small town, 5,000 people, but, "Oh, there's that sailor that came to see Mary Alice Hoffman." I mean, it was known all over town. When he left, he gave me a heart necklace, and on the card, he wrote, "In my 19 years of meeting people, I've never met anyone whom I can respect and possibly learn to love as much as you." And I have never forgotten that.
Our squadron took another Westpac tour, shipped back out again. We did river patrols, down pilot rescues. I actually got to walk through the city of Saigon, beautiful city at that time. And the action was about 20 miles up the road. We corresponded for 3 years.
He wanted to see me again, but couldn't get leave. And so he wrote my mom and asked if I could come down to California and he would hitchhike up to see me. Well, I had a gal in the dorm that lived in L.A., and my mom said, "Yeah, I could do that." He took me out to this really lovely restaurant.
A real nice dinner. First time she'd ever had lamb. So I had a little rack of lamb and all the fixings and trimmings and like that. And we're eating dinner, and I popped the question.
He gets down on his knee and proposes and gives me this engagement ring. We just kind of felt like it was meant to be. I mean, what are the chances? The only thing I can think of is my junior year of high school, I worked in a cannery, and there was a girl that worked there. She was dating a boy that was in the Navy, and she'd asked me if I wanted to have a pen pal, and I said, "Oh, no." And that's the only clue we have.
It's a mystery that we'll never know for sure how it happened, but it did. And it's all good. 50 years worth of good.
Daniel Gross produced that story with original music by John McCusick. As for Mary and Royce Thorpe, today's a big day for them. They're celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary. Congratulations. Just ahead, Kenyan women owning it in comedy and music. You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. And we're going to check in one last time with Marco Werman in Kenya. He's been there all week with our Across Women's Lives team. Marco, take it away.
Thank you, Carol. Back with you again in Nairobi on the outskirts of the city at the David Sheldrick Elephant and Rhino Orphanage. The Across Women's Lives team has had so many eye-opening and frankly really encouraging experiences this past week. As you know, we've shared a lot of our time here in Kenya with Gina Moore from BuzzFeed. She's our global women's rights correspondent and has been helping us with our Owning It coverage. And earlier today, I popped by Gina's apartment to say goodbye, but also to speak with her about one of her feminist heroes in East Africa. Gina, great to be with you again. Tell us, who is this comedian? I know she's a comedian.
That part's right. She's hilarious. Her name is Anne Kansiime. She goes by Kansiime, and she's super famous here. She's well-known, well-loved. She's also super famous in the diaspora. She just did a tour in the States, in New Jersey. She did some shows. When she came here to Kenya last week, she filled, 1,000 seats. She is beloved. And she's also, if I'm allowed to infer, pretty rich, which is to say she makes money.
My goodness. The first time, we actually, I think the first time I got a check of like 12,000. I will never forget that day.
So she's successful, maybe like the Wanda Sykes of East Africa. I know why I love Wanda. Why do people here love Kansime?
She's so real. She's so authentic. People at the show in Nairobi last week told me she just gets everyday life and figures out a way to reflect it back to people that's both really funny and tells a little bit of truth.
It's like they're just seeing themselves through me. I talk about experiences that I'm sure that they have had as children, in school, in their marriages.
Marriages, relationships, how do men feel about her comedy?
There were a lot of men in the audience in Kenya. There are a lot of men who are her fans, who've liked her Facebook page. She has more than 1 million likes. Women really like the fact that men love her too, because she says things in her skits that your average Ugandan or Kenyan or Rwandan woman can't necessarily say out loud directly to her husband, but they can, and Kansime told me they do this. Just pick up the phone, hand it over, play a YouTube clip, and then the guy gets the point.
So I know you've got some bits from her show that you attended last weekend. Give me an example of why she's so hysterical.
Okay, I'm going to share with you probably my favorite joke from the night. Kansime is talking about her husband, who it's clear she adores. She recently got married. The marriage was big news in Uganda. But they don't have kids yet. And there's this expectation in this part of the world, once you get married, the kids follow really quickly. So she got on stage and boom, she dealt with that right away and turned it into a joke. A series of jokes. The best part of the series, I thought, was when she's describing visiting her auntie, her father's sister, who in this part of the world is supposed to give you life advice, right? And she goes, and her aunt says, okay, fine, no problem. If you're having issues having children, here's what you need to do. She tells her to put, like, leaves and salt water in her mouth, to whistle, and then to do this.
I was supposed to whistle 3 times and run around the house. Chanting, or joking, 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 or joking. What are the chances that if he catches you, that marriage is still there? Okay, I want children, but not those ones.
I think that's hysterical. And the reason I find it so hysterical is because what she's doing is describing this thing that every woman here would feel the pressure to do. And then you'd feel the pressure to take it seriously. And she's like, you've got to be kidding me. Absolutely not. And she does it by saying, okay, fine, that's the limit. You know, kids, but not those kids, right? And the audience went crazy for this joke. Everybody got it. Everybody loved it.
Hey, I bring you greetings from my mom.
Hallelujah.
Hey. And, you know her.
And it's really, that's the heart of her humor, right? Like in her sketches, women win. Not always at any cost, but it's the woman who comes out being the powerful one, being the victor.
I've been told my clips tend to show women as the winning team. You know, like I always win all arguments, as a matter of fact. But I don't know how else to put, I'm a woman. I mean, if I'm not on my side, I don't know which other side I'm supposed to be on.
I mean, really, you've got to root for your own team. If you're not rooting for your own team, who are you rooting for? Gina, thank you for introducing us to Kansime Ann. And let me just say what an absolute delight it has been having you as a part of our Owning It coverage this week. You've been such a huge, huge help.
Thank you guys so much. This has been great. I think it's been really exciting.
Marco Werman, now back here at the Nairobi Elephant Sanctuary. Kansime Ann makes comedy. She made it. We've also been busy this week. Brought you a lot of stories about women taking control, owning it here in Kenya. So it seems appropriate to end with a power ballad.
Hello, it's me.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Hang on. Right song, wrong version. Let's cue it up again, please.
Hello, it may be, but I am here.
This is Kenyan Afro soul singer Della. Big name here in Kenya since 2009. Pretty well known in East Africa. Della is short for Adeline. Now, Adele, the British singer, was born Adele, so it's a coincidence that they basically share the same name. Now, Adele released her big hit, Hello, not even 2 months ago. It's number one again this week in the U.S., 7th week in a row. And recently, here in Nairobi, like just last week, Della re-recorded it in Swahili. I met Della a couple of days ago and asked her what drew her to the song.
That song
you know, they say feels, gives me the feels. Like, it just reaches me in a way that no other song has been able to in a really, really long time.
Della was with her manager at lunch not long ago, and they were talking about how much Hello affected her. And he said to her,
you know what, Della, you should do this. You should do this cover. But he wouldn't do it like everyone else is doing it. Maybe in Swahili, I was like, oh my goodness, this is just like, a light bulb just went on, like in my head, like,
Della says the translation poured out in a few hours. She speaks Swahili, of course, but she says it's also a gorgeous language for songwriting.
I love Swahili. Like, Swahili is like my first love for writing. Like, it just has this poeticness. It just reaches, like, the soul. Like, it explains everything so well.
The success of her cover of Hello, 250,000 hits on YouTube and counting, she just didn't think it was going to be a big deal.
But now, seeing as how big it's become, now we're working on it and the licensing and getting all the rights, like mechanical adaptation rights and all those things. Like, you know, this thing has been out for like what, how many days? So...
And that's how we say goodbye to you from Nairobi, by saying hello in Swahili. Before I leave you, just want to thank a few people this week. Here in Nairobi, our crew on the ground, producer Emmanuel Mwasia and driver Anthony Mburu, you guys are the best. Have to give a big shout out to Gina Moore from BuzzFeed, who's based here in Nairobi as their global women's rights correspondent. And of course, Andrea Crossan, Anne Bailey, and Isis Madrid, who worked so hard to bring you the stories we've heard this week. In our Boston newsroom, many thanks to editor Julia Barton and our producer there, Tracy Tong. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, which is where you'll find me again next week. Until then, have a great weekend. So long from Nairobi, Kenya.
PRI, Public Radio International.